Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators Present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Washboard Resonators Presents. And today we've got a friend of ours called Billy Hickling, who's a very unique drummer, percussionist, washboard player. And we first met him, we were doing a gig somewhere and he was playing as well and just really enjoyed his playing, very percussive. He was playing Bones with, I believe, a band called King Courgette at that time. I think it's the first time I saw him. And he's playing Bones on a washboard, but in this very percussive, unique kind of way. And then when we got chatting, we realized that he used to play with Stomp, the kind of junkyard brush dustbin lid brandishing band, and I think he was with them for about a decade. And Martin, you've done some work with him as well.
Yeah, I've done some work with him, and you know what, he's a fabulous kind of energy to be around. And what I find interesting is that he's made his entire living from playing music. And that's always something to be admired. And what I'm looking forward to today is I've had loads of broken conversations with him before gigs when he's done depping drumming gigs. I'm actually looking forward that we can just get his entire story and share it in one go and find out who this man is and what he's all about.
I want to hear about how the rehearsals and how all those kind of shows got put together with Stomp. So let's get into it. So Billy, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for chatting with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for asking me.
Can you tell us, we always start off with a bit, can you tell us where you're from and when you were born, if you don't mind?
Yeah, who are you and where are you from? My name is Billy. I'm from York, UK, Old York, and I'm a musician. I'm a percussionist, drummer, teacher these days, but I spent most of my grown-up life, I suppose you could call it, about 15 almost 20 years of it, in a show called Stomp.
Yes, that's what we said in our little intro. That's what intrigued us, because I think we first met, I think me and Martin were doing a gig as Washboard Resonators in York, I believe.
At the Fulford Arms,
there you go. And you were playing with King Courgette, one of your groups.
That's right. And I was playing my hybrid bone machine.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what we talked about. We'll get into that a bit later. But yeah, it was really interesting. So you're playing washboard, but with bones, and you had a little, you have a suitcase bass drum as well, I think, was it?
Yeah, Samsonite, 1950s or 40s, post-war, I think, but not by much.
Ah, that post-war tone that we're after from
Samsonite. Yeah, it's like covered in Bakelite, and that's what makes it sound so good, I
believe.
Great. Plywood with a Bakelite covering.
So if we go right back to the beginning, so did you start off playing drums?
Yes, I did. I'm a drummer and I'm kind of like back to drums now. If you have a look in the corner there, there's my pride and joy at the moment. 1940s. So
for the podcasters, you've just moved the camera so we can see a 1940s Slingerland drum kit.
1947 to 1949 era Slingerland.
So when did you start playing?
The drum.
Lessons? How did that happen?
No, I never had lessons. And I kind of wished I had, actually, now, because I'm trying to teach people how to do it. And, you know, when you've amassed this stuff, I mean, I say I've taught myself. No, I've had loads of teachers, you know, loads and loads of people have taught me. Everything that I know has been taught to me by somebody. But I had no, you know, official teaching, no kind of ratified system of curriculum or anything like that. I started with my brother, my older brother, Alfred, who's the singer and main driving force behind the King Courgette, which, incidentally, in the lockdown has mutated into the Electric Courgette. I can't wait for you. Yeah, it's all gone quite psychedelic.
That's exciting to share. Okay.
Yeah. So I started with my brother playing exclusive. See it right here. In fact, we'll be at the Fulford Arms where I met you on July the 29th with the Electric Courgette. First gig back from the pandemic. So, yeah, I started off as a drummer, but I started with my brother as a little kid, about 8 or 9, and playing on...
When was this? Sorry, Billy, what decade?
Oh, God, you want me to get... You'd never ask a lady his age.
Well, I don't want specifics, but I like to kind of paint an image, you know, I'm wondering
So this is very early 80s, and it was the Body Scanner Appeal. For Blue Peter. Now, you probably don't even know what Blue Peter is, but it used to be.
I don't know what Blue Peter is. I don't know what the body scanner is.
A lot of the kids I teach now, no idea. Anyway, because I take my Blue Peter badges sometimes. I have two.
Another exclusive, two blue Peter badges.
Two. I nearly had three, but when they brought around the box, they said, badge? I went, oh, yes, please. And my coat fell open. I already had one on, and they snatched it away. And I've never felt more ashamed in my life. But I do have two officially, yeah. And the teachers love it. And some of the kids, the hip ones, but most of them are like, yeah, which is crazy to me because it's the biggest program for kids. It was the only thing you could watch. So anyway, I digress. I apologize. There was the body scanner appeal. Blue Peter always had an appeal every year. And you got into it as kids. And this was to send body scanners to Africa or something like that. And so we put on a gig. And my brother, who's always been forcing me into bands my entire life, it started when I was eight. And we're talking very early 80s here. It's post 1979 because we'd already been into the Specials' first album. And we were already into Scar. And we were wearing little parkas and Harrington jackets, little ties and trilbies and badges. We were well into the style of the whole thing and we were mods. So the band was called Mod Kicks and then it became known as Harrington. And I can't remember which name it was for the first gig, but the first gig was to all the neighbours and we earned money for the body scanner appeal. And I played on like a plastic baby bath and some stools and some pots and pans and was way embarrassed because I wanted a real drum set, you know. Little did I know that my actual professional playing career would be entirely made up of playing pots and pans and baby baths, you know, and people would pay it and we'd travel all around the world doing it. So there you go. But from that, I became a drummer. I kind of fell in love with it immediately and fell into playing drum set. Again, I had no lessons. And now I'm all the way back out the other side, four decades later, and I'm playing drum set and really trying to catch up and learn how to drive that machine because when I did my professional time, it was playing, like I say, pots and pans, fire extinguishers, bits of old car door. And instead of drumsticks, we used hammer handles, poles, our bodies. So even though it gives you, it was my musical university, I guess, stomp. I'm sorry, I'm already in the future now. But that's where I got my real grounding on how this stuff works and how you really play together.
Yeah.
It's like exploding a drum set. So that girl over there, she's the hi-hats, and he's the bass drum. You're playing the 16th notes, you're doing, you know, a snare pattern, and it's exploded apart. So as a process to make you realise how important it is to play together, it's sort of second to none, I found. But then coming back on your own without your teammates, trying to drive this car for the first time in decades, it's been a real eye-opener for me. I've had to go absolutely back to basics, totally zen, realise I know nothing at all, and build it up from scratch. Luckily, there's been a pandemic. So as a music teacher, I've not been working. So I've been making this studio and learning how to play the effing drums properly. Yeah. And I'm starting to get to a point where I can express myself now. Like when I stomp, I can kind of doodle, you know, do stuff without thinking. Whereas on the drums, it's just starting to come now. So it's like, thank God.
I'm sensing what you're saying, though, is that you're a bit, I don't know if embarrassed is the word, but you're worried about that. But I think that's what makes you unique. It's like coming from that approach of approaching and playing a drum kit from a different perspective. That's what makes you're playing you know, like.
Well, I would agree with you there. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's worth doing. I think I have something to say on the instruments, but I want to be able to say it technically without, you know, coming up against, I don't know how to do that. My hands don't do that.
Well, that's what we're all aiming to do, isn't it? And you'd want to be able to put any thought you can into your hands, you know, and your feet. But I haven't done anything with my feet. But
body experience. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Well, can we go further back? So you're playing at the age of eight. You're doing little gigs. So when did you first get a drum kit?
Well,
and what was the kit?
The first drum set came about 2 years later. So I was about 11. Yeah. So this was not long after the body scanner appeal. And it turned out that my mum's best friend, Kate Fryatt, had a brief relationship with, I've forgotten his name. I was meant to think about this. What's Trevor Horn from
He's one of the world's biggest producers. He did the Band-Aid single, for goodness sake.
So this was around the age of Buggles, though. So Video Killed the Star. So he wasn't Frankie Goes to Hollywood yet. And you know, the world was a long way away. Well, actually, not that long, about 4 years away. So anyway, she had this relationship with Trevor Horn. And he ended up getting like a drum set for her son, Dominic, which the relationship foundered and Dominic wasn't interested. So this kit ended up in their shed, you know, for a long time. And when it turned out that little William was interested in the drums. In fact, I had one drum first. I had a Maxwin by Pearl. I don't know if you know that. That was the budget range of Pearl back in the day. So I had a Maxwin.
I remember those in the secondhand music shops when I was a youth.
There you go. Yeah. So this is new from Pep's Music in York, which is long gone, run by a fantastic guy called Tony, who was an amazing jazz drummer who I'd never realised because I was a kid. Absolute genius, and he's now long gone. But he saw my dad this Maxwin Pearl snare drum, so that's all I had. And, you know, it's not a drum set, and when you're a kid, you're not going to do rudiments unless somebody shows you how to do it. So it was kind of useless. So I had this Maxwin by Pearl snare drum. But then, from this shed, courtesy of all people, Trevor Horn, and this short-lived relationship, there was this three-piece, I wish I had it now, because at the time I was like, oh, what's this old piece of shit? Blue Sparrow, Beverly, I would say now, being a vintage drum geek, from the fittings on it, it must have been very early 50s at newest, you know, maybe even sort of late 40s.
Wow.
It was Blue Sparkle, three pieces, and it still had calf heads on it. And again, I was hideously embarrassed about that. I was like, what are these weird yellowy things? This drum set behind me now is fully kitted out with either calf or kangaroo skin hide things. You know, it's crazy how things go full circle. So out of the shed came this kind of broken down, but a sort of jewel of a Beverly. And Beverly, I don't know if you know, they were the budget Premier kit.
Not always. But they did have a good rep before that, wouldn't they?
Ah, well, there you go. So that's what I thought, because I was like, it's not even a Premier. It was probably just a Beverly. And in fact, it would have been, thinking back, because the snare was quite amazing. It was quite short. It was like a Royal Ace, Premier Royal Ace. So it had the offset lugs.
Yeah.
And then the snare was like a free-floating thing. It had a big sort of a metal bar right through the middle.
Yeah, well, was it Beverly Cosmics? Is that what they modelled on the Ludwig 400s?
Oh, God, I've no idea.
I might be confusing a few bits here, so maybe we shouldn't go down the rabbit hole, but there was a whole kind of court case because they're supposedly that Beverly made some of the Ludwig snares of the 400s from the in the 60s, because some of them have better chroming, and there's this thing about Beverly had really good chroming.
Well, this was wood. This was very shallow, and it was wooden. And it was Blue Sparkle, like the rest of it. And it did. It had this sort of hexagonal metal bar right through the inside of the drum, which I guess actually means it would have a full release, like the Rodgers.
Yeah, it's basically a super sensitive throw off. That's what they're saying now. Yeah, because it's parallel. It goes exactly, well, it doesn't go up on one edge. It goes
exactly.
Yeah. So, guys, I think we should move on.
Yeah, it must have been quite a good kit. And I dissed it at the time. This kit turned up from the shed. I was like, oh, crap. What's this shitty old kit? I want a big black power tom, kind of. Anyway, that's what I learnt on. And my first band, again, with my brother, and this time we're heading towards adolescence, was called Love from Alice. And we sounded like the Stone Roses, actually, mixed with the Birthday Party. In fact, when we both saw the famous Top of the Pops, where the Happy Mondays and the Stone Roses were on the same show, and everything changed.
When was that then, about 87 or
88? That was 1989. 1989, yeah. The Roses and the Mondays were on Top of the Pops, and Manchester just happened. If you're of my vintage, it changed everything.
That episode was on the BBC iPlayer recently, and I watched it. Have you seen it? It's amazing.
It is amazing.
Snapshot in time. It really is amazing.
As a kid, if you were there, it really was. It was unbelievable. Everything just went like that. It was like, fuck. Yeah. But also,
like guitar music.
We knew that things had changed because it was just one of those moments. It was really, I'm getting shivers thinking about it now. But we also looked at each other and went, that's us. That's Love from Alice. That's exactly what we were like playing Fool's Gold at age 13. And I suppose it was only actually 4 or 5 years earlier. So that all these things must have been in the mix in the air and in the culture of kids learning how to play. Because they were about the same age as us as well, you know, so they'd have been probably listening to the same stuff. So with that blue kit, we had a sort of proto Stone Roses kind of psychedelic vibe band. And I was always into Jimi Hendrix and the Sex Pistols and The Who. They were my major influences. Mitch Mitchell.
You know what? Now you say, yeah, Mitch Mitchell and...
And Keith Moon, really. But then finding out that actually it was all about Elvin Jones and Gene Krupa. So that changed.
Well, but I really hear those guys' influence. Only now you say that, I was like, oh yeah, actually, no, yeah, that's I think you sound a good mix to them. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'd be honoured by that. I'd be honoured. I've been working on Elvin Jones stuff lately, actually. Doing a lot of woodshedding on Elvin Jones's free time sort of stuff. So yeah, and I used to set fire to it with lighter fluid on the hi hats and the cymbals and that kind of thing. Because I thought I was Jimi Hendrix. I was also a skinhead wearing Fred Perry's by that point and big boots. And regularly getting beaten up for being this idiot who thought he was a skinhead.
It sounds like the theatrics were always within you then.
I think. Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. And my dad said, looks like a bloody Christmas pudding doing it. Because I was like, pyrotechnics. And they always know what to say, don't they, the old man. They look like a bloody remnants of a Christmas pudding. Yeah. So that took us up to early teens. And that was really where I kind of learned to play, because the lads were older than me and we would practice every week, and there'd be like a beat that they needed. They needed like a straight. I couldn't do it. But next week I would come back and I would have practiced at home and I could do it. And then something else would come up. It needed a. Couldn't do it. And then come back next week. I could do it because, you know.
But did you kind of list? Did they kind of. You had these records that you were trying to cover and then you just and worked it out essentially?
Some of them were covers, you know. I think the Double Time was a Deep Purple kind of thing. They were older, like at art school, and I was just at school. But I just always had a thing that I've just been so drawn to it that, yeah, I would work it out at home and then come back and nail it. And the look of delight on their face, as you could see them expecting, all right, we'll try and do this song with this little kid. And wham, it was like, bang on. And it was like, oh. And I think I just got addicted to that feeling, actually, of trying to please people.
Yeah.
And I've been doing it ever since.
Yeah. Amazing.
Very important for a musician. So, okay, so you're kind of a teenager.
Now, yeah, I think it was about 50.
As we all get a bit older, we get into our sort of later, sort of past 18, 19, did you go to any kind of college or did you go straight to work? Like, how did that work out for you?
I went on the road. What happened was, after an entire teenage life of playing pub gigs, that the band I was in at that point was with my best friend. And that was our kid band, and we were kind of mates forever, and that's what we were doing. And we got the opportunity as we were coming up to the end of school. So this is 1989 going into 1990, and we're taking it as seriously as teenagers will take something, but we got the opportunity to go to Poland in a van. So we jumped in a van and we drove all the way to the central Poland, the year that the Berlin Wall came down. So we drove in. Yeah, we drove in. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989, the winter of, and we drove in to this new land of freedom in the summer of 1990. So we were in a GPO telecom van called Colin with an orange flashing light. And if you've ever seen Quadrophenia, it's one of the vans that the cops use in that. So really narrow wheelbase, looks like a little bug. You know, it's not the kind of van that you send 6,000 miles away. But we did. We set off boys and we came back boys, but we thought we were men. But we went on this epic journey as a band of brothers, all at 18, 19 years old. And
did
drove
you a gig this was it? Or was this just for as a trip?
This was to go and play at the, it's called the Jarosin Rock Festival. Jarosin is really famous in Poland. If you speak to anyone, they're like, ah, Jarosin. Jarosin was the only festival that they really had in Poland. And in those days, every city had its own rock club. Every city had its own dom culturi or house of culture because it was communist at the time. And they had nothing. You know, they had no Pepsi Max. They had no Nike. They had no, MTV. All they had was music. The only freedom they had from oppression was music. So they were absolutely rabid about their music, which is generally kind of like really hard jazz or hardcore punk. And this festival was like where everyone would go to every year. It was like their Woodstocks, the Polish Woodstock, Jarosin. It's been going since the 60s. And we kind of floated in there in this crazy little van, these bunch of 19-year-olds, having been invited there to play at the Jarosin Rock Festival. The band had had a drummer before whose dad was a BBC producer and had gone and done a whistle test documentary about it the year before. They'd been invited as a band before I joined them. I was still with my brother. And then they went on this mad journey by train through East Berlin. The Berlin Wall is still there. you know, they were smuggling dollars in inside tubes of toothpaste and that kind of thing.
Wow. Having to share
their papers. And it was like that. And they came back and it was like an unbelievable experience they'd had. They did a demo in Warsaw, which was all very Trevor Horny sounding, actually. And they virtually played no instruments on it, it turned out, you know, but they'd been to this professional studio, had this sort of amazing experience, came back as transformed people in my eyes. I joined the band as fast as I possibly could. And the following year, because of this experience, it was like, okay, boys, do you want to come and play Yarashin? So we did, but we drove there. We drove through empty border posts, which had suddenly become empty. They still had, like, you know, that looked like Nazi eagles, you know, big Eastern European German stuff, but no guards. So you kind of drove in, and they'd remembered this whole, you know, kind of rifle point on the train, papers, papers, and having these, you know, dollars hidden in toothpaste tubes and Levi jeans to take to trade, that kind of thing. And, you know, just deserted. Just drove in to the east and straight from tarmac roads onto cobbled motorways. So we drove the next like 1,000 miles into East Europe, all the way to the middle of, it's right in the center of Poland, tiny little village, a bit like Woodstock, you know, tiny little village, to this football, it's not really a stadium, football park with a few bleachers. But we went and played a rock festival to 20,000 people.
Wow. What was that gig like? How were you received?
This is the thing. They said, you're the only English band who's ever played here. Don't stay on later, longer than your 30-minute slot. You know, and they may throw things at you, you know, but just get off the stage as soon as you think, you know. We went on and we played our kind of hybrid sort of pop songs plus some Hendrix covers. And we got 3 encores and they threw roses on the stage afterwards. It was insane. Talking about it now, it seems like that can't have happened, but it did.
So you were literally a cultural ambassador from the from the west to the east in 1989.
Yeah, right as it opened.
Or 90.
So you got there and the feeling of freedom was unbelievable. It was in the air. And people were just ecstatic. Ecstatic. So you had this unbelievable vibe. You had things like there was a band on before us called Big Chick, and Big Chick means big tit, and their logo is a picture of Lenin with a mohawk and an ear piercing, and said Big Tit on Lenin. And you know, it was kind of amusing to us, but if you'd done that 6 months previously, you'd have been in jail, you know. So that they were to sort of wander into this situation and then find yourself suddenly on a festival stage with roadies and proper systems and, you know, rock stars who've met Lech Wałęsa and the Pope, and they're showing you pictures of it as you're getting drunk in a little room, hotel room, before you go on stage, discovering that there's an international language, and international language is alcohol, and you suddenly understand everything that's being spoken to you. And then suddenly going onto the stage, as the lights came up, it was the golden hour too. They put us on at about 8:30, just as the lights were coming down. So the lights were going on, and you get that, you know, that prime slot. It was all a complete happen chance. None of this should have happened. Turns out we were meant to have been on at the local Battle of the Bands in the Dom Kulturi, which we missed when we drove up. It was already happening in this sort of, you know, sort of town hall. That's what we were actually booked for. We had no idea. As it turns out, the guy who had worked on the documentary with them before, who'd been this lovely little Polish guy who had worn, you know, like rayon trousers and a terrible ill-fitting ribneck jumper, who'd come to York and stayed with us, Adam, suddenly walked out of the corridor of the you know, the organisational building, strutted out, more like, wearing a full 1980s leather blouson and pleated leather trousers, you know, and a flowery shirt, was in charge of the entire festival, was suddenly, you know, it transformed from the old Eastern Europe to Trevor Horn's best buddy, and just clicked his fingers and put us on the main stage at the Golden Hour, and which we played, and got this unbelievable reaction. And it blew our minds, because we were only 19, remember, and we were making it up as we went along, and none of us had trained musicians, and none of us had ever done gigs other than in our local pubs.
Unbelievable. That's mad. And were you playing covers now, your own stuff?
We were playing our own stuff and a few covers. But so it went absolutely unbelievably well. And then after that, we went on an odyssey around Europe. We took our crazy little van and went busking down to the south of France and back again. We wanted to stay forever, and I think we managed about 6 weeks before we ran out of money and the van broke down too many times. But that changed us all. My best friend, he's still a musician. In fact, he runs his own studio and he's a sound engineering lecturer at Leeds University now. That's Si McGrath, my best friend. But all of us immediately went on the enterprise allowance. And it used to be what musicians did when you were on the dole. It meant that you didn't have to sign on for a year and you got £40 a week each. And it was meant to be like a business, it was the enterprise allowance. It was a Margaret Thatcher thing.
It was a way of massaging the unemployment figures. So they said that unemployment was down. But what they just did is shift all the artists and weirdos onto this system.
That's true. But the thing was, you got £4 more than you would have got anyway, and you didn't have to sign on, and they left you alone. So even though you could see it in a cynical way, it doesn't exist anymore. And it was fantastic. And it's how musicians existed back then. And were allowed to exist. It's like
I've heard a lot of comedians, like people like Stuart Lee, talking about that's how they kind of got their start. You could be on that and then go and do a few pub gigs and build your set, build your kind of skills.
Exactly. As a musician, it was perfect. Or an artist, it was absolutely perfect. If you were a businessman, it was ridiculous because there was no capital startup, there was no loans, there was nothing you could do. But you had to get a business plan together. You had to do this little course and say, yes, we're going to sell this many cassettes and T-shirts and that kind of thing. It's all a bit nonsense. But it gave us a year where we didn't have to go and get a job. And that's when we'd had this ridiculous experience. And we spent from 19 to 20 and 21 holed up in various bedrooms, working every day to be musicians. Now, by the end of that year, the bass player had to go to London because he was older and he was like, fuck this. And, you know, the band sort of broke up, but it put me on a path that I'm, you know, have been on ever since. So that was our kind of moment.
So moving through, so you have this amazing, I mean, it just sounds like the most wonderful
year. It was great. It was great.
You know, sort of just bohemian, you know.
We should have died many, many times, but we didn't. And we discovered, you know, travel and hospitality and people looking after you and meeting people you've never met before and the allure of the road, which is who you're going to meet next.
Mm. Yeah, it's
people. Where do they live now? We're going to meet them tomorrow. I wonder who they are. And then you would meet them and they would do amazing things for you. And it was like, this is incredible. And
there's a lovely community out there for musicians, isn't there? That you go out and then you can tap into like hospitality, people being nice. And it's a wonderful world out there, actually, when you kind of are out.
It is. It's a scary world, but if you trust the good forces, put yourself out there in good faith, I believe great forces will come to your aid. Though, of course, you can always have bad luck and crash on the motorway or, you know. But we were lucky. Lots of people are lucky. You guys have been doing it for many years as well. And I'm sure that the allure of the road must be partly some of that I've been talking about too. And then it makes you want to keep doing it because these things happen that would not happen if you just stayed at home. So for me, it was about discovering the road and then wanting to get back on it. So after that adventure, it took a long time to get back on the road. And the next time I did, it was actually in Stomp. And then it was a whole ball game.
So let's bridge between this being about 20 years old and then up to Stomp. So what happens in that interim then?
Well, we did the enterprise allowance for a year and then part of the band left. So I just continued in York being in bands. So then I was in bands all the way through until I left York, which was I was 1996. So I was, God, no, I don't know how old I was, late 20s, mid to late 20s. But the band I was in before, we were together for 5 years. That one was quite interesting because that one spawned Chris Helm, who ended up playing with John Squire.
In Seahorses.
And in fact, writing all their biggest hits, then falling out with John Squire because John Squire wanted all the publishing rights for the big hit songs, which he didn't actually write. So Chris left and then became just Chris Helm, sort of on his own. But we'd been together for 5 years. We went on a busking tour with each other, which didn't go quite as well, unfortunately. And by the time that busking trip finished after our 5 years as a band, and I'm sure you guys know bands have a time limit to them, we'd kind of come to our 5 year limit and we're going to make it or bust. Mm. Well, we bust. But a lot came out of it. Chris spiraled off into the back end of the Stone Roses. And I spiraled off into going to London, getting out of music because it had blown my mind and we'd ended up kind of homeless and upset and sad and it was all quite melodramatic. I went to London and became a graphic designer, actually. I worked in nightclubs, worked in pubs, met an old friend who got me learn it on the job graphic design gig, which I did for a few years. But while I was doing that, I had an experience that brought me back to music, which was Chris Helm phoning up saying, the drummer's left the Seahorses, do you want to come and do an audition in Wakefield? So I finished up on the computer that was still learning how to work. And these are the days that we didn't, it was a graphic design company in London. We didn't even have an email address, you know, let alone a website. And this is late 90s. You know, it's all happened so fast, it's kind of dizzying. So anyway, I jumped on the train straight after work, went up to Wakefield and auditioned for John Squire. Met him, played for him. Apparently I was too jazz for John, which he didn't tell me. And I sat about outside for like fucking 3 hours, actually, until someone came out to say, oh, he's still here. It's like, yeah, I mean, okay, shall I go home then? Yeah, so, you know, it was a bit of a shit experience, really. But I woke up the next day completely transformed. I felt like myself for the first time in years since we'd had this kind of nervous breakdown of our band. We're going to do it. And we'd had, you know, I'm skirting over this band. I shouldn't really. But I'm aware that I'm rattling on and this is going on for ages. But all of that early 90s, mid-90s was a band called Chutzpah or Chutzpah. Or if you were one of our fans from Leeds, you called them Chutzpah, which means shameless audacity in Yiddish. And we were like a free-form kind of collective, psychedelic kind of festival wannabe type band. And we played all around York, really. But, you know, we climbed over the fence into Glastonbury and blagged some gigs, that kind of thing. You know, it was the band. And we really wanted to make it. We put everything in. We lived as a band. We lived in a house together. We didn't have jobs. That's what we did. Completely committed to it. So by the time we managed to go on this sort of foreign trip, which was actually very, very positive until it wasn't, you know, it was sort of damaging in the end, you know, and enough to put me off music. I thought forever, it was like, I can't do this anymore. I'm fucking 27. I've got nowhere. I've had this amazing experience, but I've gone, pal, you know, maybe we just peaked too early. So I went off to London to seek my fortune. And as part of that, I did this audition and suddenly I felt great. I felt really great. And I realized it wasn't the music that had fucked me up. It was the people, you know, and now I realize that was me as well. But back then it was them, but it was all of us, you know, it was the people that had done it, not the music. Music is a beautiful and positive thing.
It's one of the hardest things about the industry. I think it's just like people managing basically, isn't it?
Exactly. So I realized that I had to play music. So I immediately started going to auditions all over London because I lived in London now. And it kind of, I did it because I had really didn't have any friends and I
was auditions for kind of rock stuff or everything.
This is Britpop era in London. So going to the Good Mixer and seeing Damon at the bar and that kind of thing. Joining bands, playing at the Monarch in Camden, that kind of thing, you know, and the Falcon and that places like that. And the Water Rats in King's Cross. With those bands being the big bands and us being, you know, jockeying for trying to get into it, that kind of thing.
So you're completely on the scene.
We're sort of not on the scene with those people, but in London, trying to become a working person as a drummer. So yeah, I would get the bus with a snare drum and a bass drum pedal. And
what drum kit did you have at this point?
I didn't have one.
What snare did you have at this point?
Well, I had my old one. It was a Premier pedal and a Premier snare. And the snare was from an APK set, Advanced Power Kit, which is what I had when I went to on the Poland trip. However, when we did the Poland gig, we used the APK kit for the busking tour and gigs that we found along the way. But the setup that I played, which changed my life till now, was a Ludwig Super Classic. I didn't know at the time, but it looked like Ringo's kit, even though it had two toms, so it was like a big lead. And there was this massive 80s power kit with all these huge toms. It looked like Mel Gaynor's set from Simple Minds. Double bass drums, white, huge, power tower. And I was like, why can't I play that one? And they were like, that's the one you're playing. And it had a Speed King pedal, which changed my life. And the sound, and it was one of those transcendent moments where we could have crashed under the lights and this amazing sound, and we soared. And I played like I'd never played before, and it was this amazing kit that just bounced back at you and just did this most amazing things. It turned out it was Ludwig, and as you know,
yeah, you're speaking my language now.
There you go. That's your life's work. So they really are, you know, that kind of affecting to a musician. So yeah, that blew my mind. But yeah, so I was scrabbling around the edges of the London scene in 96, 90, 97, 98. So, you know, that kind of thing had already you know, Britpop was kind of been and gone really by that point, but it's that sort of era. And that's when, because I was getting the bus from Camberwell to Hammersmith, which, if you know London, is a really, really long way, diametrically opposite, on a rainy Wednesday evening, finding yourself in Nasty Nick's studio, you know, from EastEnders, Doc Cotton's son. And you're like, oh, it must be a studio because there's a picture of him. And he's obviously invested in a studio, and it's the worst, stankiest, you know, London, horrible, just, you know, a meter band. And then end up in, like, King's Cross at the big studios there, auditioning for a band called Arnold, who were, like, kind of minor players on the scene. Didn't get the gig. But what I was doing was that was how I was expanding my map of London, you know, pre-internet, and you had to have an A to Z, and you get a bus in the rain.
How did you hear about the auditions?
Well, this is the thing. This is the cultural thing, is every Wednesday, I worked in Wandsworth, and every Wednesday I go to the CAF, and you get in a Melody Maker.
Still a Melody Maker.
Yeah, so for kids out there, this is what you used to do when you lived in London, and how, like, Phil Collins got a job, is you went to Situations Vacant. You turned to the back pages, and you had a look. And so I would go to them. So one of these Wednesdays, there was a big picture, and it had someone with dustbin lids on their hands saying, open auditions for Stomp. No experience necessary, just a good pair of shoes or boots, loose clothing, sense of humour, and a willingness to go for it. Anyone welcome. So I went to it.
And so was Stomp
20 years later.
Was Stomp now, was this the forming of Stomp, or had Stomp already existed and they were, like, expanding now? Or?
Stomp existed. They were pretty big. They've always been relatively unknown in England, which is where they're from. But this was them as the Evening Standard in London had it. Stomp come marching triumphantly back home, the biggest British theatre export ever. And what they were doing was they'd been formed throughout the 80s, they'd actually been a part of the Covent Garden kind of busking scene, or at least the guy who wrote it, Luke Creswell and Steve McNicholas, who are my erstwhile bosses, and kind of went through various incarnations, like kind of sort of mutoid waste warrior type people, that kind of vibe, that era, early 80s through to mid 80s, junk culture, finding that when they played the dustbins at the end of the set, it went down better than any of the music that they did. Or playing, you know, the Bobby's Helmet on Covent Garden got much more money than when they played the guitars. And they started to kind of get rid of those guitars.
It's entertainment, isn't it? A factor like that. So could you give, for people who don't know who Stomp is, could you give a little summary of what Stomp is?
Yeah, man. Stomp is a live music theatre show where we make music out of everyday objects. The idea is that you don't need music, you don't need instruments to make music, and that music is everywhere. So it's a bunch of shit-kicking, blue-collar, boot-wearing guys and gals who kick up a storm with push brooms, body percussion, dustbin lids. It's a mixture of dance, comedy, and music, but it's all live. There's no tapes. It's an ensemble piece. It's live theatre. And it's like a cross between a band and a theatre piece. So people get really into it if they like it. So you find that people will go again and again. So it's had this incredible worldwide life. It was birthed really from the streets, but it coalesced at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 1989. Mm. And they won an award for, like, best bit of new theatre, most kind of mind-blowing. But there's no stage, there's no theatre,
set.
Curtain. There's no curtain. They're using scaffolding. What's this thing? They interact with the audience because it came from busking. There's no fourth wall. You're not watching telly. The audience is pulled into the show. And that's why people like it as well, because you become the fifth member of the Beatles, as it were. So it went from that, and the prize for that was to go to New York and do a short run off Broadway in, like, a kind of flea pit theatre on Second Avenue at the Orpheum Theatre, which is where Little Shop of Horrors used to be for years and years, apparently. Cool. Stomp took that for a few weeks, and it's still there today. And it's been this kind of, now it's a New York institution. It has its own part of the avenue named as Stomp Avenue.
Wow.
In New York City. Americans absolutely fucking love it. In fact, anytime you go to America as a Stomper and you show them your passport and tell them why you're there, and they say, oh, Stomp, I love Stomp. And they wave you Stomp every time. And I worked in America for about a decade. It's huge over there because it rocks, and they love it. When things rock, they love it, and they took it to their own. And that gave it legs. So it became this sort of international thing with multiple tours of America, plus this little cool, little amazing theatre, which I was lucky enough to work at and do the lead role in, amongst others, in the last 2 years of my Stomp life before I came back home here to York.
That's amazing. Can we go back? So you went to the audition. What did you have to do in the audition?
So it was like a workshop. The cool thing was that it was just brilliant fun. They're really great people in Stomp. And my dad, when he met them in Paris, said, you couldn't imagine having a drink with a better bunch of folk. And it's like that. They're really, really unpretentious because they've all been brought from different walks of life. Not everyone's a musician or a dancer. You've got people who are mechanics, nurses, you know, people who've pushed a tea trolley about. And that's kind of the beauty of it. And people see, it's not a chorus line of everyone looking perfect. You've got a massive guy and a little girl and then a lanky fellow and then a chubby guy. And it's like, how the fuck are they doing that? I could do that. And then we get you to do that in the show. You get to join in. So it has an everyman appeal. But these lovely everyman people are really like that. They are kind of salt of the earth types. So they ran a workshop. It's like, okay, it's challenging. It's a memory exercise at first. So they show you a piece of body percussion, which was goes like this. I'll show you. This is what you have to learn on the first 5 minutes. If you can't, you're out the door. And if you can, you go through to the next stage, which is right, left, right, clap, right, left, clap, right, left, and repeat. And if you get that, you got through to the next stage, which was another, you got onto the main stage, they gave you a broom, and you had to work with a broom. And then if you got through that stage, here's a great big staff and a hammer handle, and you started doing kind of tribal stuff with that. And if you got through to that stage, you did all that, but here's a pair of dustbin lids. And can you move with it? Can you do a kind of weird shape or make rhythmic patterns with it? And if you got through that bit, here's the massive, great big blue drums made out of United Nations open top kegs, the kind of thing that you transport everything around the world in. So, you know, everything's made from found objects. But here's these massive, great mallets to play with. Can you count off four, play four bars, do a little solo, and then finish on the beat? So it was just fun. You know, you were learning all this stuff with these kind of crazy looking guys and gals on an open audition, which got smaller and smaller over a week. So I was there for a week and you got a cut every day. It started off with 1,000 people and went down to four. And then it was us four.
Wow. We went for a week. That's amazing.
Yeah. Job. Yeah. I mean, I didn't think for a minute I would get the job, but after the first day you thought, that was amazing. What a great experience. And then to do it again, it's like, oh, that was even better. And, you know, you're learning loads, but not for a second thinking you would actually get the gig. And my now wife, my girlfriend at the time, we'd not been together very long, and she bought tickets for the show. Well, the other thing that made the audition really cool was that it was at the Roundhouse in Chalk Farm in London, which got a huge storied history of being where all the happenings happened in the 60s. You know, it's where Hawkwind would play, it's where Hendrix played, it's where Cream, everyone played. And in recent years, it's really nice now. And, you know, the BBC have run those incredible concerts there. It was in a transition period from going from derelict to what it is now. And Stomp kind of were the act that transformed its fortunes, really. So they kind of went in there, and it was still round the back. It was all kind of lean-tos and mud and sand, and now it's all very nice. But we went to see the show and just thought, oh, my God, this is A, effing brilliant, but B, there is no way you're ever going to be in that show because these people are badasses. You know, what are they doing? They're like rhythmic Jedi Knights. How are they passing this beat around the room? What the hell are they doing? Why is it so funny? Why do they look so scary? That girl is unbelievably sexy. You know, they're swinging from the roof now. It's all done as just this amazing kind of rhythmic unit. It's like just watching a great R&B band sort of thing.
Sometimes when I've seen it, I feel like it's got roots in kind of like a Western taiko drumming kind of vibe.
Yeah, there's a taiko drumming vibe to it, definitely. It's rooted very much in British music hall tradition, I would say, as well.
Yeah, you know, plus the comedy and stuff. Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like here's the routines. It's like, and here's the men with the brooms. Thank you. And here's the people with the plungers. Quack, 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 quack. Thank you. And here's the man with the dog and the ball. You know, it's very much that. It's a bit like punk vaudeville mixed with Western taiko and world rhythms. Yeah, yeah.
I think that's amazing. That's lovely. I really enjoyed hearing the audition process of that as well, because it's probably very clever in that in no way then did you mention any kind of musical elements. Like, it was just very much like, so it's not intimidating is what I mean by that. No one's saying play a four bar for whatever, you know.
Well, they did say, can you count off four? Can you play four bars straight time, play four bar solo and finish on the one?
Okay.
So, you know, and the thing is, it's extremely musical. It's like uber musical. And that's kind of the whole point.
Oh, no, sorry. I agree with that. I meant like they're not using musical terms is what I meant.
No, exactly. Yeah, it's not kind of rarefied. It's they're doing very high level stuff, but it's totally approachable, which is why I think audiences get it. And also when you're in that process, you're just having this amazing time, you know, learning really great musical stuff without kind of realizing it. And that's the whole point too. And that's how I teach now. I just try and give kids what I learned in the show, which is how to kind of by stealth get people involved in music and be playing music before they even realize they're actually doing it.
Were there charts for how were the pieces? So you got in anyway, I'm assuming.
I did.
How did you find out the news?
That's a whole other story that went on for an awful long time. But eventually, yes, I did get in. And then we're into training in Brighton for 6 weeks, and then you're off on the road. In those days, they didn't have a show in London. They had two tours going around Europe, so you were straight onto a European tour, and that's when you were dropped in the deep end, and you had to really learn how to sink or swim. Like it's a vast amount of information. There's about 23 routines in the show, all of them kind of multi-linking, and it was all done orally. So you learn to sing the show. As it turns out, it is charted, but you didn't get to see the charts. The guy wrote the show. It is actually charted. And then the people who got kind of hip to it would make their own charts. Or, you know, even if you didn't do that, the way that you took it, taken in the information, it was charted. Because you're playing on the one or the one E, or you're the one and the two and that's what you're knocking on the broom. She's hitting there. But you would sing it. So instead of saying like, one E, one E, two E, you'd be like, boom, chica. Or you'd think of a rhyme. I can't think of one now, but what would be... anyway, you'd have silly rhymes. So everything that you would say, you know, you'd go back to this point and it would have its little phrase, as opposed to go to bar 16 and go to beat 4E. You know, you'd go back to boom, chicka, boom.
Yeah, it's like Coca-Cola, strawberry, those kind of things.
Yeah, exactly. Those venerable traditions. But yeah, so not charted and everyone learns it orally. So if you can't sing it, you can't do it, basically.
So just out of interest then, so you've got these two things going around Europe. There's also, sounds like, there's one in New York. So there's like a number of franchises, I guess.
It's not a franchise though, because it's still owned by the two guys who wrote it. So you've got, it's like an extended family. So
how many people at this point? How many people at this point are employed? Sorry, how many people are employed at this point, and how many like how big's the team? And do you get to meet all the other people that are going around eventually?
Yeah. Well, some people to a greater extent than others. I was really fortunate. I worked in all of the companies because I really wanted to. As we discussed earlier, I'm kind of addicted to traveling and meeting new people. So after every few years, I ended up in a different company in a different country. So there was five. At the moment, there's none because it's a pandemic and everyone's out of work. So there is no stop. We hope it'll come back. Who bloody knows, you know? But when I was working, yeah, there was the European tour, two. Then it went down to one European tour and a London show. That would be nightly. That's officially still going, but nothing's going. There was the New York show, and that would go nightly. And then the American tour going round America. At that time, there was two American tours. And then there'd be what we called the floating fifth, which is the regiment of old stompers or stompers not working, pulled in to do what we call double ups. So, you know, they've overbooked the show and they'd have to pull in some stompers to do 2 or 3 weeks work here or whatever. But the show in those days was working constantly. If you needed a break, you had to put your hand up and jump off the juggernaut because it would go 52 weeks a year. You know, you'd have like, there were like 8 days off in the year. And that went for years and years and years. There's bigger gaps now between the shows. You know, nobody has a glory day forever, but it is still going and it still has, you know, generally European tour, London, New York and the American tour. And some people stay on European tour for their 3 years and then leave, or do London for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or 8 years and don't go anywhere else. I did all of them and did about 3 years in each one. So I was on the European tour first, then I went to London, then I went to Boston. We did a year in Boston, but that show only lasted a year. Then I came back to Europe, became the rehearsal director for the European tour. So that's like player manager. So you have to do all the stuff.
Can I ask? Sorry, babe. So, well, first of all, so are you salaried now? You join on a salary and is everyone on the same, or the longer you're in there, the higher your salary slightly? Or
when I joined, it was a model of socialism. Yeah, I joined and I was on the same wage as the people who've been in it for 10 years. And I've discovered, like, lately, because I was always really proud that that's the way they treated people. I was like, fuck, these people are amazing. They really put their money where their mouth is. It turns out in later years, that's not the case. And there's a sliding scale and you had to work your way up. But in my day, yeah, everyone was on the same money. And it doesn't sound like very much now, but in 1999, when I joined, it was shit loads of money. It was £900 a week, plus PDs and hotel accommodation. So
I think that's still quite a lot of money.
It's still not bad. I mean, it's twice equity minimum. You know, it's not an equity show. So anyone who's been in it doesn't get an automatic sort of trade off into any other kind of job. And it's very, very specialised. So, you know, dance shows think you're a drummer, drummers think you're a dancer. You're a stomper. So you can stomp, really, or do nothing. But, yeah, they would treat you incredibly well. You'd work very, very hard, but it was a great deal. Yes. I mean, when they told us how much we were going to earn, I was like, you've got to be fucking joking. And we're doing this fantasy job of learning how to be a kick-ass kind of rhythmic Jedi, you know, and get to split the whole fucking rhythmic atom apart under the tutelage of this genius who wrote the show, who's able to see everything like that. He's got a really great wide vision sense. And him and his partner, Luke and Steve, they've just got this great vaudeville comedy, British, deadpan, you know, approachable, funny way of putting it. So it doesn't come across as an exercise.
Can you kind of break that down? How is a typical show put together?
Well, each show, each company does the same show, but each show relies on a certain amount of improvisation. So it's a bit like being in a really good jazz band. You've got the structures, but it relies on coming alive by the people in that band on that night, interpreting what they do to a certain extent.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like a locked-in machine, a human rhythm machine, but you've got to start, you overdrive it. You turn the power up to 11. And the machine starts to almost break and sparks come off. And that's what makes it an exciting live prospect. If it was all the same all the time, like actors find they can only act a certain part for so long because you have to do the same thing, exactly the same. This show is different. It relies on improvisation, probably about 10 to 15% per night. But everything else is very, very structured. So it's written in a way that it's hard to explain, I suppose. So I'll try not to go on about it too much, but it's a day in the life of a bunch of blue collar workers. So you're in stomp world when you come into the theatre, and it starts with a guy pushing a broom, and basically this guy has a dream, and at the end of the show, did he make it all up? Because he finishes the show with pushing a broom and cleaning up the workshop. You know, is he just imagined? Because he's got a shit job. Basically it comes from people who've swept the streets and have realized how crap it is, and you're doing all this stuff to amuse yourself. So you work, this guy's work colleagues come out and they're a kind of roused about bunch of piratical looking janitors or whatever they are. You don't quite know what they are. They're definitely blue collar. And it's a game of one-upmanship. So somebody has a broom, somebody comes out with the other broom and they're playing the opposite beat. And then somebody comes out and puts in the syncopated beat inside that, and somebody else comes out. And before you know it, you've suddenly got eight people playing counter rhythms. And from one man playing a broom, you've suddenly got this really, really great rhythm, because you've got hi-hat sweeps with the broom, you've got all the knocks going on and feet, and then they go into sort of upright choreographed pieces as well. So it's really trippy. The thing is, they come from that kind of early rave culture, so it goes from down at heel, low lit stuff, one guy in a workshop, to this kind of sort of dream of people, you know, knocking out the most unbelievable sort of syncopated rhythm. With who's the guy from the glory days of Hollywood, and you would look down and see all the shapes of the dancing girls and that kind of thing. Not Cecil B. DeMille, but I'm not making my point properly. It would go into choreographed shapes out of nowhere, kind of thing. You would go from free rhythm into coalesced shapes of choreography, which would suddenly lock and move, and then go back to free movement. And then wander off, and then something else would happen in the working day, and the humour of it would come from one-upmanship, like somebody's playing a matchbox, and somebody else would come and play their matchbox a bit better than they did, and then someone would come up and show them to be idiots for playing matchboxes in the first place and do something else. You know, it's a day in the life. It is the show, and it's getting through the working day without going mad. And most people can relate to that, because most people have jobs that drive them fucking potty. So, you know, we even use the break time. You get halfway through the show and it's like, all right, show's over, and you're sitting on stage with a newspaper. and then people come out, and because they're stompers, they've got the stomp urge, they can't kind of help it, and also they're stompers, so they can't read. They start pissing about with the newspaper and start flicking it on the two and the four, and he hears the two and the four, so she plays the one and the three, and then that guy starts playing a nice little counter rhythm, and the guy in the middle is just like, fucking hell, I'm just trying to have a break. And then the guy who's a little bit psychotic goes off into an entire sort of stream of consciousness, kind of manic episode, turning his newspaper into a flying bird, or, you know, a pair of binoculars, and you know, everything is rhythmic, but it just becomes silly and stupid to the nth degree of just trying to wind up this poor guy in the middle who's trying to have his little quiet break, until he throws his newspaper down, goes shh, and everyone goes, sorry, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, it's silly, it's kind of childlike, not really childish, but it's fun, and it's a nice time. It's all it is a really positive vibe, and that's why it survived so long, I think. And that's why I survived in music, because I realised music is just a positive vibe. There's nothing.
That's super interesting to hear. I think we, I don't know if you feel the same, Martin, but I feel that's what I like about doing some of the early jazz stuff. I enjoy the kind of, I like entertainment and comedic stuff. I think it has to be done well. I don't really like it that's the person's best thing.
It's got to be throwaway as well. It's got to be small and low-key, and then it works, but yeah.
I also like that you talk about the improvisation. Like, that's what I like about, like, why I probably wouldn't want to play, you know, Sex on Fire 3 times a week at weddings when they come back, because you can't improvise on that. Whereas, yeah, in our shows, when I play with other people, there is a 10, 20% element of improvisation every night. You know?
Me and my brother and my dad, and the reason I like you guys so much is we looked at it and went, that's well stomp. They're doing a really stomp little show there. Because it's very vaudeville what you do. It's English music hall. And you work with each other with the rhythms. And it's funny. It's dead stomp what you do.
Well, what you've described and what Jack's brought up, you know, is a very similar idea, that if you want to work, if you like, for want of a better word, if you want your act to succeed and move forwards or fall away, stomp being a very good example, because stomp has continued with multiple acts out there. If it entertains people, and it also it takes them on a journey, and it gives them something that perhaps they've not seen before, so it's a spectacle.
It's a musical journey.
That's going to, you know, light fireworks in people's brains. It's going to give them a great night out, and they're going to go and tell their friends, and they're going to come back with their friends to see it again. And in a very miniature way, that's obviously what we've kind of worked out, which is this idea of, like, give people something they've never seen before. But there is obviously, like, a sense of we are doing some old 20s, 30s songs. So there's a context to it. There's a picture frame around it, which is some of the traditional material and the era. Yeah. And then you put stuff within that. And I think we could probably all agree with here is that if you can entertain people and you can make the music have that, you said, I think, I can't remember the exact wording, Billy, but that kind of, that music being a force for good, that positive vibe.
Yeah, it makes it real.
People feed off that.
They do. And why else?
And you feed off it as a performer, and you want to get out and do the next show. You want to share it. You want to go around the country and stay in shitty hotels to share it and to make people happy and give them a good time.
Exactly. Because it's a buzz. It's a buzz and it's a thrill. And if you play music and it's not a buzz and it's not a thrill, then you should probably be doing something else. You know what I mean? We say we play music. We don't work music. You know, you put a lot of hard work into it. But, you know, that's what it is at its best. And when it's at its best, people connect to it, because you can't help connecting if it's well crafted. You don't see how well crafted it is. You just know you're having a damn good time. And if you can surprise people with a bit of humour, I always think that's great. You know, it doesn't mean anything has to be like Stomp, or everything has to be like the Washboard Resonators. But I dig that kind of stuff, and I think everybody does who sees it.
The humour. The humour wins people over, doesn't it? It kind of
it arms you.
It helps you connect with an audience.
Yeah. And I mean, because we've all been in bands, it's a terribly inhibited space to occupy. On both sides, you've got a band learning their craft, you've got an audience, nobody wants to dance, you get the space in the middle, if you're lucky, people dance at the end. Just, you can get rid of that often, just by going, you know, it's like in the old days, people would take an ecstasy pill and suddenly go, oh, fuck, we don't need any of that. Let's all be together, and they're empathising with each other. Oh. And if you can get that feeling of empathy just by vibing people in a well facilitated way, lead them in to the pulse and say it's safe, it's good here, it's wonderful, and you can be part of it, then it'll change their lives. you know, and you've got a really good thing going. Because as far as I can see, there's no point doing it otherwise. I think you're just pretending at music, you know, and I'm not saying that, I don't want to insult anybody there either. You know, a lot of people are putting a lot of hard work into stuff. But I think as well, I've been lucky, and I think you guys have been lucky, that you've twigged what the good stuff is. And the good stuff feels great for when you do it and the people who are involved in it. And it's like, I just don't understand why you would do it in any other way. Or I can't do it in any other way now because it doesn't feel right.
Well, you had, I mean, how long did you play in Stomp? Because you was it 20 years, you said?
15 years. And then 2 years of tailing off because I became a dad. 10 years absolutely full-time on the road in the army. 5 years of being a dad, and then 2 years of being an even later dad. So 17 years officially. Hard time, 10 years, and 15 years of like pretty full.
I think we should probably move forward a little bit to that now. So what happens after Stomp then?
Well, meeting you guys, I suppose. When you met me, that's me desperately trying to keep my head above water as a...
Oh, I didn't realise it was that you were that fresh out, right?
No. When you met me, I suppose, I mean, that was what, 2 years ago?
I think it was 2018?
We've lost a year anyway, haven't we? So it's probably 3 years now. That year's just gone like that.
I think it was July 2018. I could be wrong, but I think it was.
I think it was.
On a Thursday.
Yeah.
But can I just interject here? It's very important.
Sure.
So I met your brother, Alfred, in this guitar shop that I used to work in the Corn Exchange in Leeds. And he came in and we had all these Martin guitars. And this was about maybe 2 years before we did the gig together. And we got chatting and we both liked the same stuff. And he was telling me that, you know, he's got this band called King Gorgeous that's kind of like an old-timey, kind of humorous band. And I was thinking, that sounds familiar. Sounds like what me and Jack do. He took my email. I didn't ask for this, but he put me on your mailing list. And I get these emails through about... like one of the things that's amazing about you guys is that, you know, he's a great writer, so he's come up with all these kind of like characters. And he sends you these missives saying, well, we're going to be doing a gig, but, you know, String Bean's not happy about this, and so and so says that, and the Courgette guys are going to do this. And this whole thing, and I'm like,
no, well,
these emails. I was like, wow, he put me on the mailing list. And then time moves forward. We go to do that gig, and I can't remember when I find out. Maybe I saw it on a Facebook event or something. It says Washboard Resonators are playing, and then it came up. It says King Courgette. I was like, oh, I'm going to see these guys. I met the guy in the thing.
I had no idea you knew about us at all.
Well, no. I mean, I'd sort of. So you guys had sort of crept into my life a couple of years earlier. What happened was, and then just to tell this story, then we'll get on with how we met you guys and stuff. But like, that day we walked into that venue. We'd been playing at the Vintage Festival at York Racecourse, which is a lovely event, amazing event. Yeah. We walked in and you guys had been setting up and sound checking. And we walked in, and there's a bloody suitcase bass drum and a washboard on stage. And I look at Jack and we're like, that's what we do. never seen that setup anywhere else.
No.
And it's like, and straight away you're like, wow. And then you guys played. I remember being like, oh no. These guys are like a million tons better than us because you're all doing these characters and playing off each other, and the music's very high quality, and some of it's improvising, you're shooting off each other, and then you've got these set sort of piece songs and little things that happen. You're just like, it's like, oh, these guys are our brothers. They're wonderful. Like,
well, brothers
we're
in
all the same wavelength.
Brothers in spirit, absolutely. It's lovely to hear you say all that stuff because, to be honest, I just think we're a chaotic bunch of
amazing
family
it's
band.
Funny.
You know,
it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad, but I don't think we're as good as you as you say we are. Our semen repertoire ceases when electricity starts, is what we always said.
Right.
We've mutated in lockdown. I think people will shout Judas at us, possibly, if anyone ever came to see us again, because it's all gone rather psychedelic and funky. But same with you. When we got summoned to play to support you, because it's like, this is the band you have to come and play with, and we looked you up on YouTube, and I didn't know that Alfred had met you already, and it was like, oh my god, wow, there's more people out there who are interested in this kind of thing. And then you came in and we were like, oh shit, they're really good and they've really got their shit together. And we thought, that's really Stomp. Look at that. It's just a beautiful little vaudeville show and really, really, really tastefully put together. And again, you know, I could sort of see what was going on because I've had this experience. But, you know, it doesn't come across as clunky, like we've put this thing together. It was just this natural world that you presented. And we all, everyone in that room, and I know there wasn't many of us, everybody wanted to be in your world, you know, and it broke down that barrier straight away. And that's kind of what I was talking about. If you're lucky enough, however you do it, to be able to empathize with an audience, then you're onto a good time from song one. And then nobody's wasting their time. Everyone's come out for a good reason and you're out for a good reason. That's when, you know, you're lucky.
What I remember more than anything about the day was really nice. It's when you meet people that you're just like, oh, these people, there's just like a synergy. Was you talking about, I've got a blue sparkle Ludwig drum kit and Jack's eyes are lighting up like this.
Yeah.
And then that night you were saying like, I've just come out of Stomp, but do you know what? I want to do some more gigging around. And I was like, oh, I need somebody to do some debt gigs with one of my other bands and stuff. And you're like, right. And we changed numbers and it was very exciting. And, you know, that's a wonderful thing that you were at a crossroads at that point.
I was totally at a crossroads because what I was doing at that point was playing in the family band and teaching in schools, just trying to do the only thing that I knew how to do. So I'm passing these skills of how to, you know, sort of facilitate getting people into a pulse and how to feel and play music, you know.
So your teaching using, is this Trash Bang Man,
yeah. Basically working with kids, but earning no money, you know. And I think at that point, I just started riding for Deliveroo. And I was like, this is really, really stupid. And I do have a skill that I can use. I should try and get some gigs.
So you go from, you know, you're deliveroing and you're like, right, I want to make this work. So you start looking for more work in schools with your trash bang.
Well, no, I was doing lots of school work, but what I wasn't doing was, I mean, it pays nothing. It's grassroots. So I was working every day, but it pays very, very little. Still pays very, very little, you know. But I was doing other jobs and then it just seemed ridiculous because also I'm too old to be delivery driving. It made me really ill. I started on the coldest February we've ever had. And it nearly killed me, but I carried on doing it for a bit. It did just think, there is something you know how to do. Why don't you go out and play some drums and pick up some, you know,
gigs,
which is what I've been doing. And until the pandemic came, it was going all right. You know, I've been playing in like about seven bands by that point.
What I'm hearing here is that it's almost like the 90s again. You're rebuilding back into sort of circuit and using your drum set again. Yeah. But with like all this experience that you've garnered, what I'd love to know now is, you say you're sort of doing stuff with seven different bands. Just give those bands a plug and a quick idea of what kind of music you're playing. Because I know it's a very big range of material that you're playing with some of your bands.
There's a singer-songwriter band who's coming around tonight to the studio called Miles and the Chain Gang. We're just about to put an album together over lockdown. That should be out quite soon. You can find them on Instagram at Miles and the Chain Gang. There's Johnny and the Rizzlers, who, if you ever see him on a poster, come and see, because they'll knock you over with some good hardcore shuffling, basically. Harmonica-driven Saturday night boogie kind of thing.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah.
There's the Electric Courgette, who will be playing at the Fulford Arms on the 29th of July with Miles and the Chain Gang. I will be leaping between the two bands and trying to split my brain in axes between eras and equipment. And actually, at the moment, that's all there is, because everything else has fallen by the wayside in the pandemic. Yeah.
Yeah, but I know you were doing like, you know, like debt and pick up gigs. So I think I saw something. Yeah, like a regular thing. I saw you doing one week. It turned up and a soul, maybe like a soul pop thing or a function thing. But you are adaptable and doing what you can to put steam on the table and keep the family going and all that kind of stuff. By the sound of it.
It's more the fact that I just love fucking playing, to be honest. I like meeting
people. It's clear.
And I want to get better. So the more you play with real people and good people, the better you get. You know, that's what I learned in Stomp as well. And that's why I was driven to go to all the different companies. It's like, I want to work with the big boys in America. I want to be in the New York show because they're the dons. And you play with them and you suddenly shit. And then you get better and go back to England. And they go, shit, what happened to you? You got really good. And it's like, wasn't I good before? No. Oh, I'm getting there. Okay. You know, so play with good people and they'll drag you up to their level, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, there is no gigs, of course, but if anyone is looking for, you know, a percussionist, old-timey, washboardy, bonesy, up to any kind of style you want to play on full drum set, I'm fully committed and ready to come. And
how would they find you, Billy?
Oh, you can find me on Trashbang.com is my website, trashbang.com. And I'm on Instagram as billy.hickling and also trashbangman.
Cool. That's perfect. Okay, just to finish this up then. So we've got a few, we've got four quickfire questions that we've asked all our guests. Don't worry, they're just silly little questions. So we'll just get your opinion on these if we can. So Billy, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Oh, I would say, I don't know, keep going. Don't be a dick all the time. I would just say, keep going. You've got the right idea. I mean, I'm not a famous or even storied player. I don't have, you know, a great career or anything like that. But I do feel the music has changed my life for the better.
And I'm agree with that. I think you've had definitely a good career.
You've worked on some of the biggest, most famous stages in the world.
That's true. But it's all in the past, you know. I can't call on anyone and get a big gig right now. But I'm not going to stop playing drums and I'm not going to stop trying to do what I do as well, because I guess I'm just hooked. Can't seem to do anything else about it. So I don't know if I could say anything to him, because I couldn't change what happened. I'd probably warn him about a couple of girlfriends that were wrong-uns. You know? So don't go down there. You'll waste an awful lot of time and heartache. Music is a huge positive vibe and it'll never hurt you. People might. Your life might. But there's nothing in music that is ever going to hurt you. It's all positive. All of it.
Okay.
That's beautiful. Amazing.
Yeah, we should sound bite that. We'll have that every week for everyone.
I might get a t-shirt.
Don't be scared of music, kids. Just be scared of poverty.
Okay, the next one. You probably do this anyway, but how will you explain your job to a five-year-old?
Okay, I would say to a five-year-old, okay, can you do this?
Exactly. Yeah, that was the most, you're the most applicable guest we've had for that question.
There you go.
Okay, and next one then. Who would play you in a film of your life?
Oh, Jesus. Someone who's slightly ginger, who's not as good looking as they wish they were.
And finally, Billy Hickling, how do you like your tea?
Oh, I like my tea all the time. Unfortunately, decaf these days. I decaffeinated for health reasons. But really? I leave the bag in, a little bit of milk, not too strong, not too weak, and no sugar, if you please.
Perfect. Okay, amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Billy. That's been fascinating. It's been great to learn about your career, really, and especially all the time with Stomp. So thank you very much for giving us your time.
Well, you're welcome. I'm aware that I've rattled on and rattled on, and I hope it had some kind of cohesiveness that you could understand. All the best. Stay safe.
So there we go then. I thought that was really interesting, Jack. What did you think?
Amazing. Yeah, really enjoyed that. It's great to hear like behind the scenes of how Stomp works really, or his part in all that.
That was fascinating. And also that, why, you know, that here's a guy I've hung out with loads. And what I was kind of shocked about was I learned so much stuff that I didn't know. And you know, what a time to be alive, to be going through the Berlin Wall within 6 months of it falling. And I really loved hearing about his just attitude towards music and the privilege of being able to make music and he's maybe struggled at times to deal with that, but how he's kind of kept his head above the water. I have even more respect for him now, and it's fascinating.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And I think he wants he's continuing that forward with his Trash Bang stuff he's doing. So it's still this kind of homemade music, percussive music. But so yeah, we should say that. So if you want to check out Billy's stuff, then give him a Google at Billy Hickling, but also check out trashbang.com.
There we go. That's a very well said, Jack. Well, let's sign off and we'll look forward to whoever comes up on the next one. Bye for now, everybody.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to The Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.